did not know that Abkhazia existed, much less where it was located. Why do we keep having this discussion? Golov knew how to handle agents, but this was different than any other case he had run. Ever. He knew Igorov in Moscow was nervous about security. Golov was nervous as well. But to slow the operational tempo when the intelligence was so spectacular was not possible. Stephanie, I understand how difficult all these precautions are. Let's agree to this. You and I will continue to meet. If you agree, I will arrange for hotel rooms outside Washington for our meetings. Because we will have lots of time, I suggest we meet less frequently. This will be a lot safer. Outside Washington? Said Boucher. Are you serious? It's hard enough to get a free night in town. You expect me to get away from my staff, my schedule, and drive to a ridiculous rural Sheridan off the highway to huddle with you over a bag of chips? Like where? Baltimore? Philadelphia? Richmond? It's not going to happen, Anatoly, not even close. Golov looked at Swan smoothly. He was not going to insist on anything. This case was too big. He smiled at her. Stephanie, you are too logical, observant, practical. I ask you to agree on one element. Let us continue, but not in public. Every month we will meet in a Washington hotel, in a suite, at your convenience. Even this little place has rooms, but they are small. We will innovate, accommodate, be flexible. Your safety is my only concern. Senator Boucher, distracted, nodded. All right, but let's start with a room here. This little inn does something for me, I don't know. She looked over at Golov and inclined forward so he could light another cigarette. Golov summoned 30 years of discipline to hide his revulsion. Oh, and Anatoly, she said. I still want the number to my account in Liechtenstein. Ask them to pass it along. Stephanie, we have discussed this subject also several times. It is against center procedure to grant access to this account. The sole consideration is your security. Believe me, the money is there. The deposits all have been made. You have seen the balance figures. Anatoly, you're a dear man, said Boucher. But would you mind very much if I play the prima donna and insist? Humor me. Boucher got up and dropped her cigarette into her whiskey. Golov rose from his seat and wished her good night. As she turned to leave, Boucher reached into her purse, took out a disc and a black paper sleeve, and flipped it casually on the table. Minutes of a committee hearing last week about Pathfinder, she said. I was going to keep it until your pals in Moscow paid up, but I like you too much, Anatoly. Good night. He watched her march into the hotel, her blonde hair swaying with her stride. Golov casually put the disc into his suit coat pocket and sat down at the table. The garden was empty and quiet. He ordered a brandy and began composing the cable to Igorov in his head. Golov's Egg Lemon Lamb Stew. Vigorously brown cubed chunks of lamb with diced bacon and onions. Moisten with white wine and stock, season with salt, pepper, and nutmeg, and simmer for 1 hour. Remove lamb chunks. Beat lemon juice, egg yolks, and minced garlic and whisk vigorously into stock without boiling. Season egg lemon sauce again with salt, pepper, and nutmeg, and pour over lamb garnished with finely julienned lemon zest. Chapter 28. Vanya Igorov read Anatoly Golov's cable from Washington describing Swan's continued refusal to accept more exacting tradecraft in the relationship. He swore under his breath and considered ordering Golov to slow the case down, perhaps even to put it on ice. He changed his mind when he began reading the second page of Golov's cable, summarizing the contents of the disc Swan had passed at the last meeting. It contained a verbatim transcript of a closed-session briefing of the SSCI by Pathfinder Satellite Corporation and U.S. Air Force managers on the GLOVE project. Timelines, Gantt charts, evaluation criteria, production parameters, subcontractor requirements. It was all there. The information was spectacular. Lion T was already working on an executive summary for the Kremlin, the Executive Committee of the Duma, and Defense. He would present the summary himself. It would look very, very good. But this intelligence windfall was at serious risk. Security was inadequate, and the case vulnerable. The unflappable and experienced Golov improved the odds somewhat, and his handling of the little blonde Haradin was masterful, but nothing they could do, no regime of tradecraft or technical tools, could guarantee Swan's safety indefinitely. Igorov lit a cigarette with hands that shook slightly. There were two points of vulnerability. Golov, as resident, of course, could be followed constantly, monitored electronically, beaconed, bugged, and buttoned. But he was too good, too cautious to lead surveillance to a meeting. He moreover had a dedicated Zeta team of counter-surveillance who followed their chief as a hostile surveillance team would, at the same distances and using the same techniques, both to detect and impede opposition coverage on the resident. Swan herself posed the larger problem. She could go crashing around Washington without a thought of staying anonymous and accidentally be seen with Golov, or bring attention to herself unnecessarily. No tradecraft could control that. But if someone noticed a leak or if there was a tip, then the American mole catchers would indeed come out of their holes and never stop searching. And where would such a leak originate? For one, from the son of a bitch SVR traitor who was being handled by Nathaniel Nash, American CIA officer. That's who. Igorov slammed his fist down on his desk. Someone in this building. Someone he likely knew. There were a half dozen high-level officers outside the restricted list who had indirect knowledge of Swan and who supported the case. Vanya mentally listed them now. The owlish Yuri Nasaryenko, director of Line T, Science and Technology, and the chiefs of Lines R, Operational Planning and Analysis, OT, Tech Support, and I, Computer Service. These officers knew they were supporting an exceptional case. They could infer where it was being run. They did not know the identity of Swan, but they had access to the raw reports, and much could be gleaned. Despite their ranks and positions, they would all have to be vetted, and for that distasteful task Vanya had the dwarf, Alexei Zhuganov, Director of Special Service 2, Counterintelligence Line KR. Igorov knew the prospect of an internal investigation against his own professional colleagues would bring Zhuganov as close to a state of upuenya, sheer ecstasy, as was possible in this life, possibly with the exception of his work in the basement of the Lubyanka. Vanya had given the dwarf full authority for his internal investigation, and the little man with the big ears and the bland grin went away happy, his mind brimming. Igorov looked out the window of his executive suite. Who else could jeopardize Swan? The director, of course. Probably a half dozen or more in the executive secretariat, the president's office, the office of the minister of defense. But there was little Igorov could do about people out of his reach. Who else? The only other senior officer worth considering was Vladimir Korchnoi, director of the First Department, America and Canada, who, although he was not cleared for Swan, was finally attuned to what was happening operationally on his turf. They were good friends, addressed each other with affectionate village diminutives. Volodya Korchnoi was of the old school. He was trusted and liked by officers in the service. He also had connections throughout the service, allowing him to hear a lot of gossip, and he was currently directing the operation to get to Nash. Igorov thought how seldom he saw or spoke to Korchnoi these days. His friend was getting old. Several more years until retirement, perhaps. By that time, Igorov would be at the top of the heap. He could choose a loyal protege to take over the America's department then. Even though Vanya knew in his heart that it was unlikely, impossible, that treason resided in the First Department, he decided to add Korchnoi to the list for art's sake. He would attend to the service first, then attend to the American Nash. If you chase two rabbits, you will not catch either one, he thought. Chief of Directorate T, Yuri Nasarenko, waited at the threshold of Igorov's office like a serf waiting to be invited into a barn. Tall and gangly, even at the age of 50, Nazaryenko wore thick wire glasses that were bent and pitted with years of absent-minded misuse. He had a big head, a jutting forehead, wing flap ears, and exceptionally bad teeth, even for a Russian. He was a nervous man who twitched and jerked his head and bent his thumbs and touched his sleeves in a constant marionette show of movement. He had a large mole on the left point of his chin, which Igorov used as an aiming point when speaking to Nazaryenko, to avoid looking at the quivering entirety of the man. Despite his outward habits, Nazaryenko was a brilliant technical mind, someone who understood the science of a problem and could also apply theory to operational need or intelligence production. "Yuri, come in. Thank you for coming so promptly," said Igorov, as if Nazaryenko had had a choice of appointment times and dates. "Please sit down. Have a cigarette?" Nazaryenko sat down, shrugged his shoulders, clasped his hands in his lap, and bent his thumbs twice very fast. "No, thank you, Ivan Dmitrievich," said Nazaryenko. His eyebrows lifted and fell, and Igorov fixed his gaze on his chin. "Yuri, I want to tell you that you are doing an exceptional job with the information that is coming in about the American space vehicle. The service is being complimented at the highest levels on the work so far," said Igorov. More precisely, he was receiving compliments for the Swan case so far. "That is good to hear, Ivan Dmitrievich," said Nazaryenko. "The information is exceptional. My analysts and I are quite impressed with the brilliance of the concept." Nazaryenko looked across the desk at Igorov's impassive wrestler's face. "Of course, Russian space technology is easily the equal of this project," he added with a double bob of his Adam's apple. "But the Americans' work is remarkable." "I agree," said Igorov, lighting a cigarette. "I wanted to tell you to continue working on your analysis and assessments, but also wanted to notify you that the intelligence stream will temporarily be interrupted. The source of the information, a sensitive source that I cannot describe further for obvious reasons, is wrestling with health matters and must suspend work for a short time." Igorov let the sentence hang in the air. "Nothing so serious as to curtail the information, I hope?" asked Nazaryenko, leaning forward in his chair. His right leg and knee vibrated slightly. "I sincerely hope not," said Igorov expansively. "An attack of shingles can be debilitating. I'm hoping our source will recover soon." "Yes, of course," said Nazaryenko. "We will continue our analysis of the existing information. There's more than enough data to keep us busy for some time." "Excellent," said Igorov. "I know I can rely on you to keep working." He rose and walked Nazaryenko to the door, his hand on the other's jittery shoulder. "Acquiring this information is important, Yuri, but how we exploit it is critical. That's where you come in." Igorov shook hands with the man and watched him walk away down the corridor toward the elevators. His head to one side, walking with a starboard list, Nazaryenko looked like a Petrushka puppet in a Skolmarok show with a cut string. "If such a man is a spy," Igorov whispered to himself, "we are doomed." He turned back into his office. Line R Chief Boris Alushevsky was no Yuri Nazaryenko. He tapped once on the frame of Igorov's door and walked calmly across the room, a smooth gait with no affectation. 40 years old, he seemed older and looked thoughtfully dangerous. He was thin, dark, his sunken cheeks and prominent cheekbones were clean-shaven but swarthy. He had black almond-shaped eyes, a strong jaw, and a large nose. The dense thatch of jet-black hair piled on top of his head was wavy and thick and shiny, making Alushevsky look like a Korgi Central Committee member from Bishkek. He was actually from St. Petersburg. The chief of Line R, Operational Planning and Analysis, was responsible for evaluating all SVR operations abroad. Alushevsky's English was perfect after years in London. After returning from Britain, Alushevsky had drifted toward planning and analysis because it suited him. He had an intellect and an inquiring mind. He was, thought Vanya, also a political naïf. It seemed most unlikely that Alushevsky could be the mole. Still, He had evaluated the Washington Residenteur's procedures in handling the sensitive source, and it was Aluzhevsky who suggested the use of the Zeta counter-surveillance team to protect resident Golov during monthly meetings. Therefore, Vanya would include him in his canary trap test. "Boris, sit down, please," said Igorov. He liked and respected Aluzhevsky for his work ethic and intelligence. "I have reviewed your recommendations regarding security upgrades in Washington, and I approve." "Thank you, Ivan Dmitrovich," said Aluzhevsky. "General Golov is utterly professional on the street. He rarely has FBI surveillance. His assessment is that the Americans believe an officer of his rank and stature would never involve himself in agent handling. It's an advantage to us. The Zeta team is thorough, discreet. They will provide added protection." Aluzhevsky accepted a cigarette from Igorov, offered from a mahogany box with a tortoiseshell lid. "Excellent," said Igorov. "Technical officers in the Residenteur likewise are listening to FBI surveillance frequencies with special care. They especially are looking for anomalies in radio procedure. A change in tactics could indicate heightened interest by the opposition," Aluzhevsky explained simply, not sure Igorov understood the nuances of the game. "Boris, I would like you to continue monitoring the security situation and our countermeasures. We have a little extra time to assess the situation." "How so, Ivan Dmitrovich?" asked Aluzhevsky. "I cannot discuss the details of General Golov's case. I regret I cannot, but you surely understand," said Igorov. "It is through no lack of confidence in you, I assure you." "Of course, I understand," said Aluzhevsky. "Security is security." There was no trace of resentment in his voice. "I can tell you that Golov's source has to suspend activities for a time. A matter of illness, quite serious, actually." Igorov looked at Aluzhevsky mildly. "How long a hiatus will we have?" asked Aluzhevsky. "It will be important for General Golov not to become suddenly inactive. He must exactly mirror his previous activity levels. Any change in his profile could alert the opposition, and that would be doubly dangerous when the general resumes activity in the case." "I do not know exactly how long the agent will be inactive. Recovery from heart bypass surgery can be lengthy or quick. We shall have to wait and see. With your permission, I will draft some additional thoughts for your consideration and for forwarding to General Golov." "By all means. I would like to see your ideas." "Please submit them as soon as you finish," said Igorov, rising from his seat. "I repeat that I am greatly pleased with your work. Your leadership of Line R is quite satisfactory." Igorov steered Aluzhevsky to the door and shook his hand. SVR America's Department Chief General Vladimir Andreevich Korchnoi walked into the outer reception area of Igorov's office 20 minutes late. Igorov's personal aide Dmitry came out of his cubicle and shook hands. Korchnoi took in the fussed disapproval of the two secretaries sitting behind their desks, but he greeted them by name, and his deep brown eyes twinkled under his bushy white brows as he sat on the corner of one desk and told a story. "There was an announcement of the highest adultery level, first place, movie stars, second place, theater actors, third place, KGB. And someone shouts, 'I've been in the KGB for 30 years and I never cheated on my wife.' Someone else shouts, 'It's because of people like you that we're in third place.'" The secretaries and Dmitry all laughed. Dmitry poured a glass of water for Korchnoi from a carafe on the sideboard. One of the secretaries was in the process of telling another joke when the leather-padded inner door to Igorov's office opened and the deputy director appeared. The secretaries quickly bent their heads to their desks and resumed work. Dmitry nodded courteously at Korchnoi, then at his boss, and retreated to his little cubicle. Igorov surveyed the outer office. "Quite a lot of merriment out here," said Igorov sternly. "It's no wonder we cannot get anything done."
"Director, the blame is totally mine," said Korchnoi with mock humility. "I disrupted this office with the telling of a silly story, a ridiculous waste of time."
"Yes, and 20 minutes late on top of it," said Igorov. "I trust you have time to speak with me now." Igorov spun on his heel and went into his office. Korchnoi followed him,
nodding at the secretaries as he walked past. The door closed behind him, and the secretaries looked at each other, smiling before returning to their work. Igorov walked over to the blonde leather couch at the end of his suite and sat down. He patted the seat next to him, indicating that Korchnoi should sit beside him. "Volodya, are you making time with my secretaries? I bet I know which one you fancy, and let me tell you, they're both good in bed." "Vanya, I'm too old and too tired to sleep with anyone these days. Besides, I wouldn't want to follow your poxy ass in any way. I feel sorry for those young girls out there." Korchnoi sat back on the soft sofa and unbuttoned his jacket. "I'm pleased that you're commencing with the planning against the American Nash," said Igorov. "I know you will manage it well. It's our best chance to discover the traitor." He got up, went to an ornate cabinet, and retrieved a bottle of Georgian brandy and two glasses. He poured two shots and handed one to Korchnoi. "This is a little early in the day, Vanya," said Korchnoi. He reached his glass over to touch the rim of Igorov's glass. Both men tilted back their heads and returned the glasses to the table. "No more for me," said Korchnoi as Igorov made to refill their glasses. "I insist," said Igorov with mock seriousness. "It's the only way I can get you to stay and talk with me. I need someone I trust to talk to." "We've been friends since the academy," said Korchnoi. "Is it something about our operation? You're not having second thoughts about your niece, because if that's it, I can tell you I feel absolutely..." "No, it's nothing to do with the operation. I have high hopes for it." "There's something else," said Vanya. "I have something to get off my chest." "Are you having troubles, Vanya?" asked Korchnoi. He would not go so far as to ask how Igorov's campaign to supplant the sitting director was going. Not even their decades-long relationship would give him the license to be so direct. "The usual headaches and skirmishes. For each success, we balance a failure, the loss of a source, a defection, a recruitment. Vanya, you know how our business works. We will always have failures, but once every 5 years, 10, we will have a stupendous success. We are due another. It will come." Korchnoi sipped at the second glass of brandy. "That's what I wanted to speak to you about," said Igorov. "Volodya, I owe you an apology. I have kept something from you when I should not have. I must continue to keep something from you for a little longer, but I want to tell you a little bit." "I respect your judgment, Vanya," said Korchnoi. "You are a true friend, Volodya," said Igorov, pouring another shot of brandy for them. "I've been running an operation on your turf in the United States without your knowledge or consent. By rights, your department should have been managing the case. All I can tell you is that the Kremlin ordered that it be managed this way." Marble kept his face relaxed. This was it, the director's case, Swan. "It's not the first time we've done this. I've done it myself. If it's operationally expedient, then you have to do it," said Korchnoi, registering the lie. "I knew you would consider it professionally. I meant no disrespect to you or your department," said Igorov. "None taken," said Korchnoi. "Is Golov in Washington aware of the case?" There was a narrow window for a delicate probe. "Softly," he thought. "These are details we need not examine," said Igorov, evading the question. "I can tell you that the case is beginning to produce intelligence of a sensitivity and relevance to Russia not seen since 1949, when Feklazov was buying Fuchs ice cream in exchange for his notes on a working bomb." How apt, thought Korchnoi. We peaked as the NKVD in the 1950s. Igorov laughed and slapped Korchnoi on the back. "Congratulations are in order, then," said Korchnoi. "These are the 20-year triumphs we need." He took a sip of his brandy. "Vanya, how can I help?" "No, no, there's nothing for you to do," said Igorov. "I need you to proceed against the American even as we have to pause in the sensitive case we're running. When can you move ahead?" "As soon as is required. Your niece is ready," said Korchnoi easily. "How quickly do we need to move?" "We will have a little time. If you can move now while our source is recovering from serious eye surgery, the timing will be suitable." "Not a problem. We will be ready to travel within a few days' time.
Excellent, said Igorov.
We'll have success, said Korchnoi. You can depend on it.
I'm depending on you, said Igorov, my most trusted uchastnik, my old partner.
You old crocodile, thought Korchnoi.
He got up from the couch and looked out the enormous picture window at the pine forest below.
We've done well, Vanya, especially you. Who would have thought these two young academy graduates would have such careers?
Don't get too maudlin on me yet. We have a lot of work left to do, said Igorov. Thank you, my friend, for being so loyal. And don't be a stranger for so long next time.
They walked arm in arm to the hallway door and bear-hugged briefly.
Now I return to my office smelling of brandy and your dreadful cologne, said Korchnoi. I build my reputation as a drunk and a piedik, thanks to you.
They both laughed, and Igorov watched Korchnoi walk down the hallway, thinking,
he was brilliant and fearless once, but now he's getting tired.
He turned back into his office and closed the door. Marble's thoughts raced. He would pass the information immediately, a satellite burst transmission tonight. He imagined Benford reading the note, but there was a whiff of something else. Vanya's invitation to the fourth floor was incongruous, out of character. The apology for running an operation in his territory was so much window dressing. Vanya did not have the slightest qualms about trespassing into an area of operational responsibility. Vanya did only those things that would bring maximum credit and benefit to Vanya. He had always been like that. It was what had decided him to become a bureaucrat and leave true intelligence work to others. He reviewed the four important details Vanya had provided. The Megasource Swan was a 20-year case, providing the best information since the Atom Spies. The case was being run out of the Washington Residentura. Anatoly Golov was likely involved. Swan recently had eye surgery.
More clues for Benford, thought Marble.
Marble walked down the broad ground floor corridors and turned into the spacious cafeteria. It was barely 11:30, but employees were already bringing food trays to tables to eat their lunches. His head light and stomach churning from Vanya's damn brandy, Marble stopped at a counter and ordered a bowl of Grubnoi soup, thick mushroom soup swirling with sour cream. He saw the line tea chief, Nasaryenko, sitting at a table alone and desperately tried to slide away from his line of sight, but Nasaryenko saw him and bobbed his head in his direction. Now he would have to go over and sit with him, for as a fellow office chief not to do so would be a breach of protocol. Korchnoi steeled himself to endure 20 minutes of eating soup with the man nicknamed the Oscilloscope by junior scientists at the technical department.
Yuri, how goes it? Said Korchnoi, sitting down at the table.
He broke the heel off his bread and dunked it into the steaming soup.
Too busy, said Nasaryenko.
He was sawing at a cabbage roll with disastrous results. Korchnoi could not take his eyes away, like looking at a bad traffic accident.
They have us working overtime, new data coming all the time, translation, analysis, drafting summaries for the fourth floor. An avalanche of disks. They're sending everything to the Kremlin.
Interesting. Disks. Must be the same case with high-volume production.
Do you need some help? Could I send an analyst or two?
This was an unprecedented act of largesse. No department willingly offered such help. Nasaryenko's head shot up, impressed and surprised.
Vladimir Andreevich, that's very kind of you. I appreciate the offer, said Nasaryenko, chewing half a cabbage roll. But the work must be confined to a small number of cleared analysts. It is a requirement.
Well, let me know if I can help you in any appropriate way.
I know how it feels to be swamped with work, said Korchnoi.
We should have respite soon.
Igorov told me there would be a temporary suspension of information. Nasaryenko leaned over his plate toward Korchnoi, his Adam's apple bobbing as he puffed his cheeks out.
The source has had a bout of shingles. He's incapacitated.
Nasaryenko was committing a serious breach of security, but Korchnoi was a fellow department chief after all, a clandestine operator with a well-respected record. Marble felt an icy finger trace his spine. The cafeteria walls closed in on him. The voices in the room became a dull roar. He made himself take a spoonful of the soup.
"Well, that's certainly good news for you. We take all the breaks we can."
Korchnoi lowered his voice.
"Yuri, we probably shouldn't be speaking of these matters. You know about the sensitivity of this activity better than I. Let's not mention this conversation to anybody. Don't you agree?"
Nazaryenko's dark brown eyes flickered guiltily when he realized what the general was hinting at.
"I agree completely," he said.
He gathered his plate and stood, murmuring apologies for leaving so suddenly. Marble sat alone, forcing himself to spoon more soup, trying to appear natural and at ease. Was this the beginning of the end of him? Was this a snare? Did they suspect him specifically? Or was this a general test for loyalty? He wryly shook his head at Vanya's canary trap, variants fed to God knows how many senior managers with his little silver spoon. "Here, little colibri, little hummingbird, how do you spread your pollen?" His message to Langley suddenly became more critical than ever. Grubnoi soup, mushroom soup. Soak dried mushrooms and strain. Add soaking liquid to beef stock and boil mushrooms for 4 hours. Sauté finely diced onions in butter until golden and add soup. Whisk in cornstarch, stir, and simmer until thickened. Season and serve with a dollop of sour cream and parsley. Chapter 29. Benford sat in semi-darkness in his office, the COFCOM message alert cable on the small square of visible desk amid the landfill chaos of the rest of it. He had read Marble's cryptic message twice, hearing his voice as he read the words, seeing him conserving the limited characters allowable in a burst transmission. He bellowed to his secretary to fetch Nate and Alice immediately. While he waited, he read the message again. 1. Swan definitely in U.S. V says Swan material best since 50s. Pass he working out of capital city. Golov likely handler. Nazaryenko claims work overload. Disks and technical data. 2. V running canary trap. Nazaryenko told big source suffering shingles. I told he recovering eye surgery. Other variants likely. 3. V renewing op versus NN. I assigned direct exclamation point. V niece in my department targeted against NN. 4. Anticipate travel Rome coincide with EBES conference. Will advise when out. Nico. Benford's eyes lingered on the lowercase n in the Nico signature, which in simple terms was the no duress indicator, but which more specifically meant that Marble had not composed the message with a circle of men standing around him, one of whom was prying the little finger of his left hand straight up, close to the breaking point as he wrote what they wanted. Swan was a mole in the U.S. government. Game on. That this was considered by the Russians the best case in years suggested Swan's intelligence had quality as well as quantity. It meant to Benford that the United States was hemorrhaging information. When Alice stuck her head in the door, Benford told her he was assigning her a single project, starting right now. "I have the double agent thing in Brazil," said Alice bluntly. She was not afraid of contradicting Benford. "That bullshit can wait," said Benford without looking up from his desk. "I want you to drop everything and compile a list. It'll be unlike anything you've ever done before."
"Do tell," said Alice, vaguely looking for a place to sit.
She found none and remained standing in front of Benford's desk. "It's going to be a little unconventional, but that's right up your alley, Alice," said Benford. He looked up. "I want you to draw up a top 10 list for me. I want you to identify the 10 biggest secrets in the United States government. Could be military, political, domestic, cyber, banking, space, energy, Islam, or the tattoo on Pat Benatar's ass. I don't care."
"On whose ass?"
asked Alice.
"Pat Benatar, the pop singer," said Benford defensively.
"Start with the Pentagon and their hottest SAPs, military secrets. That's what excites the Russians the most. Find out what the DOD considers their ultra-sensitive projects. Long-term, expensive, strategic. Get the Deputy Director for Military Affairs to make a call to SecDef if necessary. Politely ask them to get off their asses and hurry up. Then when we see what they could consider the crown jewels, we can begin reviewing the bigot lists. Alice moved to the door just as Nate entered. As they squeezed past each other, Alice turned to him. "Do you know who Pat Benatar is?" asked Alice.
"Never heard of him," said Nate, clearing files off a small chair and sitting down.
"Is he the FBI guy in Boston who covered the New England thing?"
"Forget it," said Benford.
"Thank you, Alice. Get started on that right away, will you?" Benford turned to Nate and handed him the copy of the Marble message. He could see Nate's cheeks color as he read about Dominica. Nate reread the message as if he could squeeze more information out of the spare lines. He looked up at Benford.
"She's alive."
"Not only is Diva alive, but it appears she made it through the ringer," said Benford. "And now her uncle has had the inexpressible good sense to assign her to Marble." Benford thought again of Marble's succession strategy.
"Do you think she'll come out with Marble to Rome?" asked Nate.
"I suggest you take a cold shower," drawled Benford. "She may never be totally trusted, or alternatively, she may be fully reinstated. Right now, we take advantage of the fact that an agent recruited by you, Diva, and narrowly cleared in a recent CI investigation, has been assigned by an unsuspecting center to seduce you with the goal of eliciting the name of the senior SVR officer you handle, Marble, who coincidentally is Diva's new boss and who is directing her in the operation to unman you, his case officer." Benford looked at Nate from between twin towers of newspapers and file folders, the medieval alchemist who's misplaced the philosopher's stone.
"You love this shit, don't you?" said Nate.
"I expect you to deal with ambiguity. If you are not capable of it, you should leave immediately." Benford glowered at Nate.
"Well, how would you proceed?" asked Benford, throwing him the bone.
Nate took a breath and tried to clear his mind of Dominica. "The message tells us that they still have no clue about Marble, his identity."
"And how do you conclude that?" asked Benford.
"Igorov is dangling different variations of stories about Swan in front of various department heads. It shows he's desperate."
"What else?" said Benford.
"If Igorov has been feeding his top managers varium meals, it suggests he suspects he will get results, that one of the variants will get back to him."
"And?" said Benford.
"And that suggests he has someone inside the U.S. government who would be positioned to hear a variant and report back, in the intelligence community.
Swan?"
"It could," said Benford. "What other tidbit in the message could help us do something about finding Swan?" Nate looked down again, then up at Benford.
"And give me a clue," Nate said.
"Nasser Yanko." Nate looked at the message again. He looked up suddenly.
"We know the variant told the Nasser Yanko," said Nate, "so we spread that variant around carefully, keeping track of who we flog it to. If Nasser Yanko's fortune suddenly changed, we have a place to start, a finite list of people."
"And Vanya Igorov's barium meal turns into a barium enema," said Bedford. "In all of this, please do not forget that he's impatient and desperate. You represent a shortcut for Igorov to solve the one problem that will keep him off the bascule of the guillotine. He's concentrating on you." Nate was thinking about Dominica again, and Benford saw it in his face and groaned theatrically.
"Enough about you, disappointing as that may be," said Benford.
"Clear your mind and tell me what you would do in the immediate matter of Swan. If Marble is correct, the case is being run here in Washington by the resident himself.
If Golov personally is handling Swan, that's a weak point for them," said Nate. "I think we should consider covering the resident."
"Brilliant. But how do we work Golov? What would you do?" asked Benford, nudging Nate forward.
"We starve him for a month. We surveil him pretty close, shut him down.
Look, don't get mad, but we should bring the Phoebes into this.
If we're going to be playing with Golov in downtown Washington, the FBI has to be involved. The FCI guys, foreign counterintelligence, are the best. Real spy chasers, and the G's know what they're doing on the street. Awesome surveillance team.
total coverage. They'll make so much noise that Golov will call a dozen aborts and a dozen tries. He won't be able to meet Swan. The center will start getting nervous. Golov will start sweating. They'll be frantic about losing contact with their agent. And we can only guess at the effect it will have on Swan.
All right, so now you've made him nervous. He's still too good to make a mistake on the street, said Benford. And he'll have CS covering him, too.
That's okay, said Nate. One dark and stormy night, we let him go surveillance-free. He'll seize Black, his counter-surveillance will confirm it, and he makes the decision to make the meeting. We have the Orions and trapdoor up and running ahead of him. That's when we maybe get a glimpse of a nervous Swan pacing on a street corner or pick up the license plates of an out-of-place car parked wrong. And we keep trying till we hit.
Benford nodded approval. The kid had been on the other end, staring into the FSB barrel on the mean streets of Moskva. Benford knew what an agent's vulnerabilities were, what scared his handler. Nate was coming along, he noted with satisfaction. Benford owned the Orions, kept them off people's screens, didn't loan them out. Who would want them? The geriatric surveillance team of retired field officers. Clunky cars, black socks and sandals, birdwatchers' binoculars. The size of the team was fluid, grew or shrank depending on personal schedules, grandchildren's visits or doctor's appointments. It was the very nature of the Orions, slow, patient, thoughtful, that made them so effective. It was impossible to goad them with provocative countermaneuvers. They watched, waited, faded in and out. They caressed their targets, they sniffed delicately, they flooded and ebbed like the tide, but they never stopped coming at you. And they used trapdoor. Only a certain kind of surveillance team could make trapdoor work, a different kind of coverage, a philosophy, the difference between a dog chasing a car and a cat watching a bird. They had worked on it for some time. The Orions had perfected it, greased pencil on laminated maps. The overall compass vector telegraphed by a rabbit who is, after all, nothing but human. Never mind the twists and turns, the reverses and funnels. Tell me where he's going, where he's headed. They had brought federal surveillance experts in to observe the Orions, wanted to train other teams to get the same results, wanted to put a label on their black magic. Predictive coverage based on profile analysis, they wrote. Situational projections supporting discrete surveillance, they wrote. Anticipatory deployments determined by route of march, balanced by mitigation of acceptable risk, they wrote. Pretty much all nonsense, the Orions said. It was about developing a feeling, making a guess, taking a chance. The feds blinked at them. Think of it this way, said the 68-year-old team member who early in his career had tapped the GRU telephone exchange from the Berlin Tunnel. We're an amoeba. You know, protoplasm, flexible, soft, stretching out ahead on either side, flowing along the edges. The expert smiled politely. How the hell do you put that in a field manual? During street demonstrations, the experts looked for the Orions in the usual surveillance team positions. They had disappeared. This isn't coverage. The target has been left unobserved. Where is the team? But when the rabbit arrived at the site, the Orions were waiting. Parked in the neighborhood, in the park, at the crossroads, waiting so quietly that they didn't see them. Crackpot ideas. Alchemy, said the feds. Thanks very much. They left the Orions to Benford. So they began looking at Golov, and the assessment began. Quite a distinguished gentleman, still a proto-commie, smooth and unruffled. Get to know him, said Benford, and mind the CS team covering him. Stay loose, observe, stay invisible. All right, Benford said. It's time to put Mr. Golov out of work for a while. The next morning, the FBI G's were outside the embassy of the Russian Federation on Wisconsin Avenue, slumped in their Crown Vicks, wearing Oakleys, with Bring It in their faces and 250 horses under their hoods. Closed sessions of the SSCI to discuss intelligence matters were held in room 216 of the Hart Senate Office Building on Constitution Avenue. Designated HS for Hart Senate in congressional directories,
The building was a 9-story black glass and marble tower, not at all like the more elegant and neoclassical Dirksen and Russell Senate office buildings. Arriving alone, Benford crossed the soaring atrium lobby and took the stairs to the second floor. At room 216, he entered the outer office, registered with the guard behind the counter, and surrendered his mobile phone. He stepped through the open gray steel vault door into the committee room. He was early for the session, and the room was empty except for aides distributing folders at each position on the raised oak dais. Of course the dais was raised, thought Benford. Senators enjoyed looking down at witnesses. Invisible behind the marble and wood-paneled walls, ceiling, and floor of the committee room was a hatchwork grid of copper filaments, continuously pulsing energy that ensured that, once the latches dogged the vault door tight against the copper finger stock around the frame, no signals could penetrate into or escape out of the room. In the 1980s, in an attempt to eavesdrop on sensitive SSCI testimony, the Russians had mounted an operation to leave behind recording equipment in the room that could be retrieved later, a simple technique to negate the electronic chastity belt. The audacious plan had been foiled by a janitor who found the device, which had been glued beneath a chair in the audience gallery during an infrequent open session of the committee, and turned it into the Capitol Police, who promptly passed it to the FBI. Rather than replacing it and feeding the Soviets disinformation for years, thought Benford, looking around the august chamber, the FBI had exulted in a foreign find, a listening device planted by the opposition, and ground the recorder to pieces under its heel, an opportunity squandered. Benford was the only person seated at the witness table. An aide placed a small card with his name in front of him. At the member's insistence, Benford held a counterintelligence briefing every 3 months for the SSCI, a session that only 15 members of the committee were permitted to attend. Senators, long accustomed to staff aides hovering nearby, grudgingly complied with the requirement that no staffers be permitted in the room, which meant that few, if any, notes would be taken. Members rarely missed Benford's quarterly CI brief, generally reckoned to be the most concise and informative presentation available from anywhere inside the intelligence community. But for a single member of the committee, the SSCI treated him with respect. Only Senator Stephanie Boucher from California seemed to harbor intense dislike for IC witnesses, specifically those from the CIA. As the members trickled into the room and sat down, Boucher looked down at Benford with a scowl. Benford ignored her and made a note in the margin of his briefing outline. The committee members were seated, the staff aides filed out, the vault door was swung shut. As it closed, a small green light came on over the door. The chairman simply said, "Mr. Benford," to indicate that he should begin. Benford quickly highlighted developments in a Chinese cyber case on the West Coast, but referred members to COD, the computer ops division in the CIA, nicknamed the Codpieces, for a more detailed briefing on the nature of the threat. Benford moved to a sensitive case where the CIA and FBI had detected officers of the DGSE, the French External Intelligence Service, servicing a drop site in upstate New York. A joint briefing with the FBI's French regional ops group, nicknamed FROG, on French activities inside the continental United States was being prepared. Benford turned the page of his briefing book. "Senators, the CIA, along with the U.S. Navy and the relevant contractor, has finished the preliminary damage assessment from the Russian illegal in New London, Connecticut." Benford looked down at his notes. "While the Pentagon is still preparing a report on the long-term ramifications of the penetration of the Navy program, initial conclusions are that the Russians did not acquire sufficient technical intelligence to materially degrade the operational viability of the platform." "Excuse me, Mr. Benford," said Senator Boucher. Her fellow senators recognized the attack display and braced themselves. "Why do you use platform when you can just clearly say submarine when talking about them?"
"Submarine, then, thank you, Senator," said Benford. He waited for the codicil. Boucher expostulated briefly on the outmoded capabilities of U.S. subs as compared with the class of ballistic submarines just now making their appearance in the Russian Navy.
She is well-read, thought Benford. The senator swerved again.
But wouldn't you say that the real counterintelligence issue, the real teachable moment coming out of New London, is that neither American intelligence nor law enforcement had the wit to detect, locate, and apprehend a Russian illegal officer operating in the United States for nearly half a decade? This illegal, moreover, had infiltrated the program with apparent ease despite background and security checks.
Boucher tapped a pencil on the blotter in front of her. Since the end of the Cold War, Senator, the classic use of illegals is extremely rare. Even the Russians acknowledge that it is a costly and inefficient way to collect intelligence, said Benford. He would under no circumstances mention how they had gotten onto the illegal in the first place.
That's not at all what I asked, Mr. Benford.
Pay attention. I asked which agency, in your opinion, is the more incompetent, the CIA or the FBI?
I have no opinion on that matter, Senator, said Benford. In the aftermath of the New London affair, we unfortunately have bigger fish to fry.
What kind of fish? Asked Boucher. We have indications that the Russians are running a separate reporting source, someone with good access.
We are just starting. There's nothing confirmed, said Benford.
Stop this tap dance, snapped Boucher. What are you talking about?
Benford took an audible deep breath. He closed his briefing book and folded his hands on top of the cover. He looked at the Senate seal on the wall above the members' heads.
We have fragmentary information that there is a high-level penetration of the U.S. government with exceptional access to national security secrets currently being handled by the SVR.
How close are you to identifying this leak? Asked the senator from Florida.
We do not know who, what, or where, said Benford. We're checking every possibility.
Sounds like you don't have the slightest idea, said Boucher.
Senator, these investigations take time, offered the senator from New York.
Boucher laughed.
Yeah, I know all about these investigations, hundreds of people keeping busy and drawing salaries, but no one seems to catch anyone.
Benford let the members talk among themselves for a minute before raising his voice again.
As we try to develop more information, we do have an unsubstantiated report that the individual in question might suffer from an incapacitating condition. Shingles. It may be useful later as we narrow our search and begin cross-checking.
This is all inconclusive, said Boucher, turning toward the dais.
If my committee colleagues have no objection, I must excuse myself for another important meeting of a separate committee.
She turned to Benford.
I'm done for today.
Boucher rose from her seat, gathered her classified folder, and walked to the door. The other senators rustled papers and fell silent as Boucher opened the massive door and left the room.
Benford did not raise his head. It was done. 15 of them had heard shingles. 2 days earlier, 3 undersecretaries of defense in a Pentagon briefing had heard the same thing, and in 3 days so would the special assistant to the president and senior director for defense during a brief to selected NSC staff. As he snapped his briefcase shut in the empty SSCI committee room, Benford pictured the jowly faces in the Kremlin and thought,
"You want a canary, comrades? I'll give you a canary."
General Korchnoi had been summoned to the director's secure conference room on the 4th floor of Yasenyevo by Vanya Igorov's aide. Dmitri had called him the instant he stepped into his office, even before Korchnoi had hung his coat in the closet and sat down to review morning traffic. It sounded urgent. The general looked wistfully at the covered plate of sirniki, hot cheese pancakes with sour cream that his secretary had left for him, and that he had planned to munch as he read. They would grow cold and rubbery before he could get back. As he left his office, he rolled up one of the pancakes and stuffed it into his mouth. Since he had discovered that Vanya was playing games, setting canary traps, dredging for the CIA mole within the SVR, Korchnoi's double life hardened from a now familiar baseline of danger into one of imminent, guilty dread. For 14 years he had lived under constant pressure. He had learned to accommodate it, but there was a difference between spying undetected and being hunted. As he pushed through the front doors of headquarters each morning, he was never sure whether he would be greeted by stone-faced security officers who would hustle him from the lobby into a side room, Every time the phone rang on his desk, he could never know it was not a summons to a windowless room filled with unsmiling faces. Every weekend outing was a potential ambush arrest on a wooded country road or in a lonely dacha. Korchnoi got off the elevator and walked past the portraits. "Hello, old walruses," he thought. "Have you caught me yet?" He entered the executive conference room to see Vanya Igorov sitting on the corner of the table laughing at something Line KR Chief Alexei Zhuganov was saying. "This is the little domovoy, the little goblin who stuffed rags into prisoners' mouths before shooting them in the forehead because their cries for mercy bothered him," thought Korchnoi. Zhuganov watched as the general walked across the room toward them. Igorov's big marble head glistened, and his shirt was fresh and starched. He hugged his old friend and waved him to a seat. "I wanted to meet here, Volodya, because they can set up the projector. Since you're now directing the operation, I wanted to show you some extra material." He picked up a remote control and pushed a button. Projected on the wall was a grainy photograph of Nathaniel Nash, hands in the pockets of a coat, hunched against the cold, walking along what looked like a Moscow street. "You wouldn't know this man, Volodya, but he is the CIA officer Nash who is handling the traitor. He was posted to Moscow for less than 2 years and left approximately 18 months ago." Korchnoi wondered first whether the surveillance photo of Nate had been taken while he was on the way back from one of their meetings. Then he wondered whether this was all sarcastic drama to bait him. Would the conference room doors burst open to admit rushing security men? Was Igorov this devious? Would he be inclined to torment him this way? "No," Korchnoi thought, "it's nothing. This is your life, breathe it in, circle the abyss, stay cool. This Nash is very skillful, but for one bungled near miss, we were never able to determine even a mote of his activities." Igorov paused to light a cigarette. He offered the pack around the table. Korchnoi filed away the words that seemed to confirm he was still safe. Unless this was all Igorov's elaborate red herring. "I personally believe that the traitor is in the service," said Igorov, while Zhuganov looked evenly at the image of Nash on the screen. Were they playing with him? Korchnoi thought. Zhuganov easily could be this diabolical. "It is an assumption you're making about the service," prattled Zhuganov. "One thing is for sure, the Americans would not run the extraordinary risk of meetings in Moscow to handle a low-level source. Say something, be casual." "If you're both right, brothers," said Korchnoi, "and he's a big fish and he's in the service, then the short list of candidates would be the director, you, Vanya, and the 12 department heads, including Leosha and me." Korchnoi saw their sour looks. What was he doing? This was exhilarating madness. "That, of course, is not considering that it could additionally be your special assistant or secretary, or a communications code clerk, or 100 other employees with indirect access to cable reading boards, their bosses' inboxes, and to unguarded conversations in anterooms and the cafeteria. Clerks and records see more sensitive paper in a day than the three of us combined see in a week." Korchnoi could tell from Zhuganov's expression that he had already calculated all that. All the more people to interrogate. Korchnoi decided to stop there. Too much analysis. Too many pat phrases. Igorov ground out his cigarette. "You are exactly correct, Volodya. There are too many possibilities. We'll catch this Sforlash only if we get a credible internal lead, or if we catch him or his handler on the street. These two options could take months, even years. That's why our third option is the only one." "Ogovorenyo, agreed. Your niece is our best chance," said Korchnoi. The scene was unthinkable, improbable, impossible. He suppressed insane cackling laughter. He was discussing finding the spy, flushing him out, exposing him, catching him. Zhuganov swiveled in his chair, his feet not touching the carpet. "And if your niece does not succeed in a reasonable amount of time, perhaps we then consider other means." Igorov turned to him quickly. "Absolutely not. I have received instructions from the highest levels. No active measures in this operation. Is that clear?
Suganov swiveled a little more, a faint smile on his face.
You're right, said Korchnoi. In the history of our service,